Gather round, children, listen. Let me tell you a story about a village that is filled with his glory. No sorrow in this place. Just lift your voice and say, let's celebrate. Look like it's gonna be a lovely day. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate. Forget the worries, throw your problems away. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate. Turn smiles and your smiles and smile.
Tuesday, November 6th is an important day. Your vote matters. When you go to the polls, vote for Issue 4 that will allow casino gaming in Arkansas. It's an opportunity to bring jobs for thousands of Arkansans, new tax revenue for the host cities, and for the entire state. So on Tuesday, vote for Issue 4, paid for by Driving Arkansas Forward.
Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration. If you haven't voted, you're probably making plans to vote on November 6th. African Americans are paying particular attention to three gubernatorial races. One of those is in Maryland, where former NAACP President Ben Jealous is the Democratic candidate. Joining us to talk about that race and other races is the director of the Urban Studies Institute at Morgan State University, Dr. Ray Winbush. Dr. Winbush, thank you for joining us.
How you doing, Vicki?
I'm doing well, thank you. You all just released a poll in conjunction with The Afro, which is an African-American paper in the Baltimore area. And what did your poll show as it relates to this gubernatorial race with Mr. Jealous and the incumbent, Governor Hogan?
Well, you would expect, and it showed in our data, that in terms of African-Americans, the 600 voters that we interviewed, that Jealous is favored overwhelmingly by black folks. Hogan, the Republican, though, enjoys a 30% approval rate among African-Americans. In fact, 30% of them rather say they will vote for him. But overwhelmingly, black folk prefer Ben Hogan.
So when you unpack
Ben Jealous,
this,
I'm sorry, Ben Jealous, go ahead.
Yes, when you unpack that data and you look at the percentage planning to vote for Mr. Jealous, what is it that they like about his platform?
Well, they like the education issue. Younger people are voting for him. He represents young people. He's an organizer in the community. They like that about him. These same voters, though, I think the ones that are more interesting are those black people who are voting for the Republican governor here.
And what is it that they find attractive with the incumbent, Governor Hogan?
They say that he's been very supportive of educational legislation, even though there's doubts about a lot of that. They also say that he seems to, has distanced himself from President Trump. The voters that we sampled, 84.5% of them really dislike Trump. I mean, it's visceral. And even though he has separated himself from them, much of the, if you want to call it drag on his campaign in the African-American community, is because he is simply a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea, the USA Today poll that came out last week that shows that when voters are going to be voting in the midterms, are really voting for Trump or against Trump or his agenda, is actually true. And even those so-called moderate Republicans like Hogan here in Maryland, he's at a disadvantage, and is reflected in the data that, we collected.
So when you look at your data and then just sampling across the country, is it fair to say that this 2018 midterm election is a referendum on President Trump?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, I think that the turnout that will come next week will be primarily because of Trump. He's entered races. You know, we've been fortunate in Baltimore that and Maryland that he hasn't really said that much about the gubernatorial race. He has, though, as you know, just called the brother that's running for governor in Florida a thief. Andrew Gillum, even though we know that the FBI set up Andrew Gillum to buy those so-called Hamilton tickets. That's the big controversy down there. And with regards to Stacey Abrams in Georgia, he has sided and ignored the obvious voter intimidation and suppression that's occurring in that state. So this is a referendum on Trump, no doubt, and our data show that.
The voter suppression that has been reported around the country, you've studied elections and voter behavior with respect to African Americans. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I thought the worst that I had seen was in the 70s and the 60s, right after the passage of civil rights legislation. But this stuff is so overt now. It's not even being hit. Georgia is not the only example. You may know out in the Dakotas that there's many Native Americans are being suppressed in their attempt to vote because they have post office boxes rather than addresses on the reservation, and they're not being allowed to vote. So we're seeing names switched around on ballots, not only in Georgia, but also in Florida, where there's that other group. So this is widespread right now. The only way the Republicans can really win now is to cheat. And we're seeing that because voter suppression is cheating. And because of the alienation of moderate Republicans from Trump who have moved to the independent level, the party, the Republican Party, which has been captured by Trump, is a relatively small group of loyal followers. He has maintained that 34-35% absolutely loyal followers throughout his entire presidency, which seems like longer than it was, almost 2 years old, and it's not going anyplace.
What is at stake for African-American voters in this midterm election?
Well, the country's already going to shift relative to the Supreme Court. The legacy of Trump is going to be impacting black folks and women and other groups for the next 40 to 50 years. The Supreme Court, he's gotten two Supreme Court appointments, and it's just like the Warren Court of the mid-1950s impacted voter rights, civil rights, open housing, affirmative action for 50 years. That court is now officially dead. We've had relatively moderate to liberal Supreme Court. So his appointments are going to have an impact. The tax cuts on on Americans in general are going to have an impact. So the legacy of this president, which arguably is one of the most corrupt administrations in American history, the legacy of this administration is going to last into my grandchildren's lifetime.
Well, what we're seeing is that African-American voters and other Americans of color are motivated to get to the polls. So it seems that the message has been received and people can see for themselves. In your polling, what other data did you all uncover?
Well, we looked at ages as well. Now, keep in mind, these are black Maryland voters, but if our data kind of represent the country in general, this is by far the most disliked president in American history by black people. Bush has enjoyed higher numbers. Again, we had about 84.5% of those disapproving of him. Interesting enough, the biggest disapproval, and this kind of troubled us as we're still analyzing some of this data, but younger people have less problems with Trump than the older generation. Overall, you know, all groups have problems with him. But it's interesting, this past weekend, we saw this so-called Black Leadership Summit in
And it was and a bunch they were of younger.
And,
how do you
that's
explain
troubled.
That?
Well, I think this is the generation that has grown up without the Civil Rights Movement, where they have always known they had a Black president for 8 years, and they kind of see this almost a Pollyannish view of, you know, the presidency, the White House, and so forth. I'm worried about the fact, and we are at the Institute looking at these data coming from the young people who, again, they don't like Trump, but not as much as the older sample that we got, who have experienced problems during the civil rights era and so forth. Young people have to read more history, I think.
And they found a poster child in Kanye West.
Oh, my God. He's the this Blexit thing that he's trying to, you know, exit Democrats into the Republican Party. It's affected a lot of young people. There's a growing group. I can't think of this young lady. She's Black. And she's kind of like the darling of Fox News right now because she denounces, you know, Democrats and anybody who supports the Democratic ticket. So they're having spokespeople that are very loud, very vocal, like Kanye and others. And, you know, that troubles me because that means that there's no sense of history among this group. It's not a large group. But even the data that we polled showed that younger people don't mind Trump and don't see him as threatening mm-hmm. as older people. And that has a lot to do with their exposure to history.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of history, the joint poll that Morgan State and the Afro worked on to produce is fairly rare. We don't often see two African-American institutions collaborating to produce a poll. Going forward, more collaborations, and can you see something like this on a national level?
Oh, absolutely. We've been planning this. Dr. Francis Draper, the owner of the Afro, people may know that the Afro is the oldest continuing published news, Black newspaper in the country. It's been published since right after the Civil War, continuously. And we started having these talks almost 10 months ago about a joint poll. There is no national Black poll conducted by Black institutions in this country. We've already done that research. So the gubernatorial race in Maryland, which is historic, we decided to kind of pilot our approach to the data as well as the polling here in Maryland, but we plan on going national. And in fact, in the process, probably within a year, we're going to be doing national polling the way Gallup, Harris, mm-hmm. or any other organization does. There's just an absence of this around the country, and we wanted to do it.
And there is a need. We look forward to the national polls, and thank you so much for sharing the data from the poll that you just completed. Dr. Ray Winbush from Morgan State University, always a pleasure to have you with us in the Village.
My pleasure, too. Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you settling into your new job?
I like the company, and I really like the town. Just having a hard time finding places for my dry cleaning, car repairs, and restaurant. And I really want to support Black-owned businesses.
Have you tried the app created by the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce? It connects you to Black-owned businesses all around the country.
Sounds great.
It is. It helps you locate Black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's exactly what I need. Thanks.
For more information about the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org.
Tuesday, November 6th is an important day. Your vote matters. When you go to the polls, vote for Issue 4 that will allow casino gaming in Arkansas. It's an opportunity to bring jobs for thousands of Arkansans, new tax revenue for the host cities, and for the entire state. So on Tuesday, vote for Issue 4, paid for by Driving Arkansas Forward.
Honey, did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea. Where is my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org.
Welcome back to the Village Celebration podcast. As far as elections go and politics, record number of women entered the process this year running for office. Women, while not necessarily while holding office, but in other ways, have always contributed and, of course, still do in great and small ways to the preservation of this country. In Arkansas, there have been some very impactful female change agents. And joining us to talk about her latest book, Arkansas Women, Their Lives and Times, is Dr. Charisse Jones Branch, professor at Arkansas State University. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Jones Branch.
Well, thank you for having me.
When we talk about Arkansas women who have certainly had an impact, the first one who comes to my mind is Daisy Bates. Dr. Jones Branch, if we were to do a Hall of Fame, Arkansas women, Daisy Bates in it for sure. What other women?
Oh, well, Edith May Irby Jones, Dr. Mamie Catherine Phipps Clark, Adolphine Fletcher Terry, Hilda Callard Cornish, and these are just some of the women who are in the Arkansas Women book. That's not even mentioning all the other women I know about who should have been in this volume or who should at least be in a subsequent volume, but they aren't. All these stories that we just don't know. And even people like Daisy Bates, many people know that name. They only know very few things about her life and her activism. So what these articles do is really flesh out the contours of these women's lives in ways that most people aren't even thinking.
Well, let's talk about it. You've done extensive research, and you've named women that I've never heard of. So If you had to pick some of the ones that you think we need to know about, tell us, who's on your list?
Well, I think we can always stand to know more about Daisy Bates outside of the Little Rock Central High School moment in 1957 because, for example, a lot of people don't know that she was a sponsor of the Spirit of Cotton contest, which was essentially an agricultural contest for young black women. She was also a rural activist. So those are two things people tend not to know about her. And in this book, there's also, we actually begin, and I have to also say this, I co-edited this collection with my colleague, Dr. Gary Edwards from Arkansas State University. And the first article in the collection is Women in Early Frontier Arkansas. Mm-hmm. They did all the work except hunting by Dr. Sonia Tucci, who's a professor at the University of Central Arkansas. So we really don't think much about the fact that there were indigenous women here long before the first European settlers. So I think it's really important to know that there were all kinds of women here long before Arkansas was a state, before it was even a territory.
And what were their lives like? I envision a lot of hardship.
I think for all of these women across the board, in one form or another, there's hardship. But yes, probably very much so for indigenous women because they're encountering people they probably didn't know very much about, and certainly these people didn't know very much about them. And we rarely hear very much about indigenous women in Arkansas anymore. So that history is lost. And some of these people, of course, were moved out of Arkansas and sent to Oklahoma and places like that. And so we know that they suffered hardships because of that. But we also don't know very much about their history.
If you had to describe them in, say, a sentence or two, just overall, the women of Arkansas are
creative. They are innovative. They are take charge kind of women. They are women who, despite their marginalization because of their gender, were change agents in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love the direction of the book. Tell us how it all came about. And your research largely focuses on women in Arkansas. And I might add, you have another one that's already in the works. And I love the title of it, Better Living by Their Own Bootstraps. And you focused in on rural Black women's activism in Arkansas.
Yes.
How did you
yes.
get involved in this type of research?
I always tell people that when I wrote my first book on interracial women's activism in South Carolina, I ran across a Black woman who was a home demonstration agent who lost her job because of her civil rights activism. I had no idea what a home demonstration agent was. And by the time I realized that this was probably a very special thing, that book had already gone to press. But I told myself that I wanted to know more about that in Arkansas. And I learned about, and it just sort of spiraled from there because I was really interested in learning more about home demonstration agents. But what I discovered was there's this whole world of rural Black women's activism that no one had talked about, no one had written about. There are no books on it that I'm aware of. They may come up in other people's books, but there's no single volume that talks about rural Black women's activism anywhere, let alone in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the research was just intriguing to me because what it required to put a book like that together is looking outside of the traditional archives. So a lot of the women that I talk about, their stories are not in traditional mainstream archives. I had to look at other resources. I had to talk to at least one woman who's still alive, and I had to talk to other people who knew these women, and I had to look at non-traditional sources. I had to get to know people who had resources in their houses and not in the archives. So the way I had to mine for these women's stories was very different from what I've had to do for other projects.
And what did you find out about them? What are some of the common denominators?
Well, that they're all hardworking women. And the thing I always tell my students when we talk about this kind of thing is that we need to understand that Black women in the rural agricultural South may have been laborers and perhaps they were sharecroppers or what have you, but their work was not who they were. So when we begin to understand them in these more nuanced and complicated ways, then we get these different kind of stories where, yes, you will have a woman who picks cotton by day, but she's the president of a club at night.
So they were far more complex than
who
they appeared to be.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that was very important to me, and I do want to talk about the Arkansas Women book, but one of the things that was very important to me is that we recognize that not all Black people left the South. Many of them chose to remain in the South. They may have gone to southern urban spaces for a while, but then they returned to the rural South. And they fought to make their community the best that it could be. So I think a lot of people think that southern-born women do this in urban places, typically northern urban spaces, but that is certainly not true.
And how did they go about affecting change? You mentioned the one woman who may have labored by day, but she was the president of a club at night.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
were their avenues for change?
Well, for some poor rural Black women, it might have been as simple as having curb markets where they sell eggs or they sell chickens or something like that. So if you're talking, and many rural Black women, rural women do this kind of work regardless of race. But if you think about the fact that in the Arkansas Delta, the vast majority of agricultural laborers are going to be African American and there are no jobs available, it's these women's curb markets that keep the family alive. It's also things like them being members of home demonstration clubs where many people think that they're just learning how to can tomatoes and preserve food, but they're also telling people, if you can afford it, go pay poll taxes so you can vote. So this is political activism, and not just that, dangerous political activism, because the last thing white landowners want is for their Black agricultural labor to be politically empowered. And we're not talking about women who have tons of education. But we are talking about very intelligent women.
Mm. And so how is it that somehow they've become over overlooked when their contributions were so significant?
I think it is because they didn't leave the kind of traditional records that we tend to associate with historical research. So many of these women did not leave diaries. They don't leave papers anywhere. So what that means is, as a researcher, I have to think really creatively about how I can find these women's stories so that I can piece their lives together.
Mm-hmm. The church is a good place, but for agricultural laborers, the records of the Extension Service, the Agricultural Extension Service, is a good way to begin to see what these women are doing and to begin to piece their lives together in that way. So church records, but certainly agricultural extension records. And, of course, what people fail to realize is there are middle-class black women in the rural South mm-hmm. who are members of clubs like the Arkansas Association of Colored Women, and there are more than a few rural black women who have national and international connections.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not thinking about them in this particular way, then it doesn't occur to you to look for them in certain contexts.
I understand what you're saying. Better living by their own rule, by their own bootstraps, rural black women's activism in Arkansas. I can't wait till the book is published. Let's go back now and talk about Arkansas women and their lives and times, which you co-authored with a colleague. Arkansas women, Arkansas in general, it seems is often overlooked.
Yes.
Same thing happened with women in the state?
Yes, absolutely. If they're overlooking Arkansas, then they're definitely overlooking women of all stripes. Because people tend, when they think about the South, they're not including Arkansas, right? When we think South, we think Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, places like that. But people rarely don't think about Arkansas, unless, of course, it's Daisy Bates and the Little Rock Central High School crisis.
And then we're not necessarily included on the other side of that geographic map in the Midwest. So that kind of leaves Arkansas in an interesting space.
Yes, absolutely. Because it really does depend on where you are in the state. Like I live in the Arkansas Delta, very close to Mississippi and Memphis, Tennessee, which is a very different reality from Fort Smith, Arkansas, which of course is minutes, literally minutes away from Oklahoma.
But the women in the state, you say, have done some amazing things that would rival women in any other state. So how do we go about celebrating them and sharing their stories? Anyone in particular, if you had to pick one or two out of the book to put in a mark on a marquee?
One of the ones that is particularly intriguing for me is about Sue Cowan Morris, which was written by my colleague, Dr. John Kirk, at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock. And Sue Cowan Morris was an African-American teacher at Dunbar High School in Little Rock. And in 1942, she sued the Little Rock school system for equal pay because black teachers, regardless of their educational background, were paid significantly less than white teachers.
That was courageous.
It was very courageous of her to do that. And she did lose her job, right? I mean, she won the case but lost her job. She later regained it but lost her job. But we're talking about a woman who attended the University of Chicago, places like that. But she's being paid less than white teachers. So that story is really interesting to me. Also, the story my colleague Gary Edwards wrote about a woman named Amanda Trulock, who was a Yankee mistress. She was from Connecticut, but she also owned a plantation. I believe it was just outside of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And so it was really interesting to read that to understand how she grappled with coming from a place like Connecticut, which is a free state, but also being a plantation mistress down in the Arkansas Delta.
Now that sounds fascinating.
Yes. Yes. So there are all kinds of stories like that. We also have one about a woman named Freda Hogan, who was a socialist in Huntington, Arkansas, which is written by Dr. Michael Pierce at the University of Arkansas. So what really I think is so intriguing about this book is that we're hearing names and getting stories that we tend not to associate with Arkansas. But as I tell people all the time, whatever happened in the rest of the country happened in Arkansas.
And we are so glad that you are chronicling it and sharing it with us. Again, the title of the book is Arkansas Women, Their Lives and Times. And then the one that is soon to be published is Better Living by Their Own Bootstraps, Rural Black Women's Activism in Arkansas. Both are fascinating topics and place women in the spotlight, women we should know about today.
Right.
Dr. Charisse Jones-Branch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Tuesday, November 6th is an important day. Your vote matters. When you go to the polls, vote for Issue 4 that will allow casino gaming in Arkansas. It's an opportunity to bring jobs for thousands of Arkansans, new tax revenue for the host cities, and for the entire state. So on Tuesday, vote for Issue 4, paid for by Driving Arkansas Forward.
Honey, did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea. Where's my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to USBlackChambers.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Village Celebration. I'm Vicki Newton. 1 week until the 2018 midterm election, millions of Americans have already participated by way of in-person early voting. 33 states it's allowed. Joining us to talk about the final days of this election cycle is political consultant Mundell Robinson. Mundell, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be with your family. It's real good.
Big news in Florida, President Trump calling gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum a thief. What's been the pushback?
The pushback is, I think people are numb to the silliness that comes out of President 45's mouth at this point. But I think he's underestimating the ability for him to motivate the wrong voters to the polls. So I'm excited about the fact that black and brown voters, people that are normally sporadic voters or low information or infrequent voters, are running to the polls in droves. We saw this in the primary. It's how Andrew Gillum, the day before election, the primary election, was in all the polls in number three, but finished in first place with a resounding victory. The same is going to be the case for the general election. These old tactics about, you know, playing to the white people, the white voters' fears, It's an outdated model because white people don't make up the majority of voters anymore. So when you're talking about the people who are moved by this nationalist talk, that section of the voting population is so small now that it's not enough to turn out them and excite them. That'll help you in states where there's small populations, i.e. Montana, Alaska, and states like that. But in states where the electorate is more diverse, Trump tactics are gonna backfire on him. He continues to forget that he won the election not because the majority of people voted for him. He won the election because of the electoral colleges. He actually lost the majority of votes by more than 4 million votes. So state elections, midterm elections, get to remind him of that because he's not on the ballot. It's not a national election. It's state by state, and he'll see how many seats he's gonna lose.
So he handed Andrew Gillum some political gold, or at least a nugget, maybe.
I think in the rawest term, he did. I also think his name and him continuing to campaign through all of the stuff that happened last week, and him being Donald Trump in general, is going to excite the base for in Florida and also in other southern states that meaning progressives, don't normally win in.
So we're talking about the pipe bombs and the continued rallies.
Exactly.
Despite
the pipe bombs, the shootings. And him refusing to call past presidents and, you know, let them know that he's aware of what happened and that he's going to handle it, you know. So his pettiness will come back to bite him, and it's going to be called him losing the House for sure. And then us even winning a Senate seat in Mississippi with a black Democrat.
FC.
Yep.
So let's talk about that race. But first, let's go north to Georgia, Stacey Abrams, Democrats, locked in this fierce battle with Brian Kemp, the Republican, who has been accused of voter suppression. What's your take on that race?
Accused and also convicted, so to say. There have been two federal courts that told him in his tenure as Secretary of State, in, you know, the person who controls and oversees those that are elected in Georgia. You know, two times his laws have been shot down by federal judges. So this is not just accused. You know, this guy has been, federal courts have said what you're doing is illegal and you need to stop. But I also believe, I don't think it's the race is as close as people think it is. They're saying 47-47 or him up by 2 points or 1 point. I believe the problem with polling is, just like I said, people are calling, these polls are asking 200-300 people across the state of Georgia. That is, Georgia's more diverse than people think. The Asian American population is growing rapidly. The Latino brothers and sisters are moving there fast. And then not to mention the large segment that is the black people. And then you add that with the white progressives. And a lot of them, Georgia has a young population. So a lot of people don't have house phones, so they're not being polled. And because they're not being polled and because they're not regular voters as it pertains to midterm elections, the pollsters aren't calling them. The pollsters are calling people that vote normally, which actually leans to a more conservative population. But this election cycle, the number of women that are on the ballot, the number of women of color on the ballot, the number of young people on the ballot, is going to do something different to the electorate. And we're going to see presidential, like, election year numbers for not just in Florida, but also in Georgia as well. And not to mention Stacey Abrams is the future of what a Democratic candidate needs to be to win.
So let's go back to the coalition you see heading to the polls in this midterm election. How do you account for their momentum? Is it all Donald Trump inspired, or for the most part?
I think, you know what? I think it's, some of it is Donald Trump. A lot of it is Donald Trump. But I think what's more inspiring, or what's pushing younger voters to the poll at a higher rate this cycle, it's going to be the fact young and also, I should say, minority voters. It's the complacency in which the Republican Party is with Donald Trump. I feel like if the Republicans were holding Donald Trump more accountable, then people wouldn't be as excited as they are. But because this president has had free reigns to do and say things that are beneath regular humans, let alone the president, I think that is exciting, and people want to check this government. They want to, you know, they want a divided government, which people believe works best anyway.
It seems almost a visceral reaction in a lot of parts of the country to what's been going on in the nation's capital. Are we seeing a redefining of the African, of the American narrative? Or an affirmation of this is who we are?
I mean, what's happening right now in front of cameras and 24-hour media is an affirmation for sure. I mean, Donald Trump didn't get elected and change. Donald Trump was the same person as he was running for presidency and years before. And you know, we talk about the alt-right now with a louder voice because they have a president that's singing the same tune. But the alt-right, if you remember, became a thing when George Bush was president as a backlash towards him not being conservative enough, or him being too much of a globalist, you know, which is code to, you know, caring about other people other than white folk. That's the code language they use. So they of course they've been strengthened and empowered by having a president who calls himself a nationalist and, you know, speak their language and accept their endorsements. But this is not a new phenomenon for sure.
Now let's go to Mississippi and the senatorial race there. Mike Espy, new political chapter. He was the agriculture secretary under Bill Clinton, and now he's back. What's the race looking like for him?
I actually, you know, here's the thing. Mississippi is an interesting space. People talk about Mississippi as if it's impossible for Democrats or progressives to win. But in actuality, what happens is you have a two-party system that has for so long ignored the black population. Mississippi has a large segment of black voters, I think more than any other state per capita, I mean percentage-wise. So when they see a Senate candidate in this election climate, or this political climate, I should say, at this time, with everything that's going on, the possibility of having a black senator from Mississippi, which is the history of like black senators, right? Like right after slavery, that's where the senators, the first black senators, came from the South. So I believe, and I know from doing work in Mississippi, helping elect the first black district attorney in the 16th district, I believe that the defeating of white racist candidates like in Mississippi isn't as hard as we think it is. I think a little bit of work we'll see, and we'll see that. Even in Texas with Beto O'Rourke, who's losing in the polls by 12 double digits, I promise you when it washes out, I'm not saying he's going to be victorious, but he's going to be a lot closer than 10 points because people aren't, the polls are flawed in general just because of who they're calling. They're not texting those polls. They're not texting youth voters or people that don't vote in every election. I just call it area people that vote in every election. And it's like, if you look at the turnout in the primary, for instance, there were black precincts with low information voters who had never voted in primaries, not even for Obama, that voted this cycle. There were precincts in Duval, and that's Jacksonville, in Orange, which is Orlando, and Broward, which is Fort Lauderdale, in that area, that had 70% and 80% increases in black voters in those precincts. 70% and 80% increases in people that didn't even vote for Obama in the primary.
That is amazing. And in Florida, there's also another issue on the ballot that's bringing out voters. Tell us about that one. And it also impacts the number of African-American voters on the rolls.
Indeed. Florida has Florida is one of the three states that will take your voter rights away if you're ever convicted of a felony permanently. And they have, the voters of Florida said they want to change the amendment or the Constitution. So they got enough signatures to put it on the ballot. So Amendment 4 in Florida is to restore the rights of formerly convicted citizens, giving them their right to vote back. Right now in Florida, there are 1.6 million people that stand to get their voting rights back if this passed. And what people forget is just because the raw number or the people convicted of felonies is 1.6 million, they have an average of 4 or 5 family members that can vote. That's a massive number of people that are excited about, you know, their family members being made whole. There's tons of studies that show that once people can vote, they're less likely to recidivate, meaning go back to prison. They're more productive. They're more likely to get a job and also be involved in their community, and it puts more money in their pockets of the family. So this is the right thing to do. I think it's going to pass overwhelmingly, and I definitely believe that Amendment 4 will be a vote boost for Andrew Gillum.
Let's talk about the Democrats.
Mm.
They raised a lot of money.
They raised a lot of money.
Cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is helping to some degree. What else have they done to help themselves or hurt themselves?
I'm a firm believer that you need money to run a campaign for sure. It's expensive. But Democrats always raise a lot of money. They don't spend it wisely. And this is the same thing this year as well. For the most part, candidates up and down the ballot, unfortunately, are doing the same thing they always do because they're told, led by, you know, consultants from D.C. that told them that it's important to spend 70-80% of your budget on TV ads versus talking to voters. And that's a failed strategy. We saw Hillary Clinton outraise Donald Trump by huge, huge amounts of money. And she spent 70-80% of her money on TV. It's not the way you don't win election with these TV ads. It's an old way of campaigning for so many reasons. But right now, baby boomers are no longer the largest portion of the voting bloc. My millennials are. Millennials don't take news from TV, or they don't take TV in general, except for like the way they want it on the internet. So it's a bad thing. I think Democrats did the same thing this cycle. They always do. They listen to DC consultants about how to spend money. And for the most part, they spent most of that money on TV ads. And the reason consultants like ads is because they get a percentage. They make a percentage off ads they sell, right? So if they got a $20, $30 million ad buy, they get 15, 20%. They're fine with that. But if you're talking to voters, if you have to first understand those voters and have a message that's going to resonate, or you have to, you're just wasting money. And then secondly, you got to run those programs. And consultants don't like to run those programs because it requires work.
Well, the most well-known Democrat of all is back in the game, former President Barack Obama. What's his impact, you think, on the November 6th election? Can he move the needle?
Yeah, I think the benefit that Obama's giving voters right now is actually the better benefit is not just him going to campaign for certain candidates. That's a good thing. I definitely think that's a good thing. But it's a different one. It's a reminder that the way Donald Trump is playing president is not normal.
Mm.
Right? And it's people are remembering that, hey, there's civility that's supposed to come with that office that's missing, that's lacking. And so the benefit is Barack is out there looking presidential, and Donald Trump's on the trail looking like a schoolyard bully.
Mondale Robinson, I think that sums it up. Thank you for joining us and sharing your insights.
Did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea. Where's my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org.
Tuesday, November 6th is an important day. Your vote matters. When you go to the polls, vote for Issue 4 that will allow casino gaming in Arkansas. It's an opportunity to bring jobs for thousands of Arkansans, new tax revenue for the host cities, and for the entire state. So on Tuesday, vote for Issue 4, paid for by Driving Arkansas Forward.
The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Making Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank, working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC.